Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me on the Ask a Theologian podcast. I'm Dave, and I'm your host. On Ask a Theologian, I chat with various theologians about their work, their theology, and how that relates to practical living, how we can bridge the gap between the theory of theology and the practice of daily living. If you enjoy the podcast, it would be just great if you'd consider writing a review, leaving a rating on whatever platform you use to consume your podcast, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We just really appreciate it. On today's podcast, I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Leonard Sweet. Dr. Sweet is a really well-known theologian and author, having written well over 70 books. He is a specialist, or his particular area of interest is what's called semiotics and seeing the signs of the times. But for this episode, we sat down and we chatted about his latest book, or referred to as one of his latest books, Designer Jesus. We talked about theological anthropology, and Dr. Sweet has a lot of insights, and I know you will enjoy the podcast today. So why don't you sit back and enjoy as you listen to the Ask a Theologian podcast. So here we go. Welcome to our podcast. This is going out to our church, talking about theological anthropology.
Okay.
I don't know if you, is that even the best way to describe it, theological anthropology?
I like made up words and made up concepts. Yeah. So
I think that was your made up word for that one. Theopology? I don't know. I think we need to have a Dr. Leonard Sweet dictionary. I know that you do like made up words. I've been reading them for 40 years. So,
well, when you get a whole new world, you got to come up with some new words, right?
Well, that's true. You know, talking about theological anthropology, I think one of the big questions is why should this matter to anybody? Church is talking about it, but you know, it's like anything else. There's so many demands on our time. Why does it matter what we believe about God creating us and all the rest of that?
Well, it's like everybody, I think, is entitled to their birth story. And they need to know, parents have an obligation to tell their kids in as great a detail as they can possibly muster what that birth story is. And so we also have a birth story as humans. And it's important that we get that right. And we know our birth story. What does it mean to be human in a world that has kind of lost its understanding of what is humanity and what is humane?
Right.
What does it mean to be human? And I really think that one of the biggest questions of the future is precisely this. What does it mean to be human? So that's one of the reasons why I wrote Jesus Human. What does it really mean? Let's go back to the very beginning, to origins.
Yeah.
I mean, that word originality truly means go back to origins. It doesn't mean
right.
come up with something new. It means go back to the origins, the original, and re-understand and reframe who you are in light of that original. Our birthday, our creation account, our birthday story here is in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And so that's why it's important to know. That's why this theological anthropology, as you call it, is so critical.
Now you've got me thinking.
Theological
anthropology seems really dull now. I'll have to, maybe by the end of this time, we'll have a new word for it. One of the things in the creation story is that whole idea of us, mankind, being made in the image and likeness of God. How would you describe like the characteristics of Imago Dei? Because I think that's a question. What does the image of God look like in humanity now? Because that would be a key understanding in knowing who we are as humans.
Well, that's where I think the word logos is so important. And I do think, Dave, there's just certain words you have to know in the original.
Right.
I mean, you can't translate them. I mean, so every Christian, it seems to me, every follower of Jesus has got to learn a little Greek and Hebrew.
And
I'm unrepentant about this. Everybody listening to this podcast knows Italian. Every one of them, they probably have a vocabulary of 200 to 300 words of Italian. You can't get through life without knowing Italian. Everybody knows Japanese, some Japanese, you know, karaoke.
A little bit, yeah.
Tsunami, sushi. I mean,
right.
So why do we think we can get through our Christian life without knowing some Greek and Hebrew? You don't have to know how to read it. You just got to know. And one of them is logos.
What I mean.
Logos. And the best translation I've if you have to translate it in English, is the DNA of the divine. The DNA of the divine.
Wow.
And the divine DNA, we've been dipped in divinity. We humans are, that does not mean that we are divine. And that's where this stuff goes crazy. I mean, if you have a ice cream cone, you dip it in chocolate, it's not a fudgesicle. It's an ice cream cone dipped in chocolate, you know? So we are humans, these creatures that God made, but dipped us in the divine. So we carry that DNA of the divine with us. And that's why I really tried to, in the Designer Jesus book, to move from, I don't like the word transformation. I think we may have talked about that. I really think the best word is transfiguration. Mm. But the really best word is Christification. Discipleship is really Christification. What does it mean that we become little Christ? And so that's the importance here of being created in God's image. So we carry. So that's why I just had this mantra: you can't be human without the divine. It makes us human.
Right. Now, the Orthodox Church, Eastern Church, you know, what we would call sanctification, I believe they call it deification.
Well, it's called theosis is the technical name.
Theosis. Okay.
But
you didn't make that up, right?
No. Not a long story word, right? Yeah. That's the technical word that it gets translated as deification, but it's really means, in the best sense of this word of Eastern Orthodox, they've captured this, that the more in which you allow yourself to be infused by the divine, the more human you become. So it's this paradox that we are the capstone of creation because of this. Yeah. That's what it means to be human, is that you carry this DNA, or I put it, you've been dipped in the divine. And
dipped in the divine. I love it.
Yeah. It does not make you divine. That does not make you a deity. And that's where people go crazy. Human.
Right. And that's the big paradox, isn't it? The more we connect to the divine, the more human we become.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know you have a painting as you come into your house that is in some way a representation of an Eastern Orthodox concept, the perichoresis.
Right.
The divine dance. And we talked about that in church. And can you tell, I don't want to go way off track, but can you just tell me the story about that painting? I think the church would love to hear that.
Well, Picasso was asked, there was a fundraiser for Soviet Jewry and what to do about the Soviet Jews. And so he was asked to do a painting that could be a fundraiser. And others were asked too. And Chagall was asked to do one as well that would be a fundraiser. And his first question was, did you ask Picasso? And did he say yes? And they thought it would be good. But yes, he said yes. He said, well, I'm not going to do it then. So these artists have rivalries we can't even understand, you know. But
yes, they do.
So Picasso did this fundraiser for Soviet Jewry, which is basically, it's literally red and yellow, black and white circle dance.
Right. Yeah.
These kids are dancing in a circle, and he colors these kids, you know, red and yellow, black and white in that order. And then in the middle of it is an ascending dove with an olive branch apiece. You get the circle dance, the perichoresis. That's really what a carol means, a Christmas carol. Carol really means the circle dance. And so you get that beautiful image of one of the first interpretations of how does the Trinity interact with one another.
Right.
It's a circle dance. Yeah. But the dove is ascending. I hate dive bombing doves for some reason. It just doesn't, it doesn't remind me of a peace symbol.
Pigeon or
you got to have an ascending one, or at least one that's,
That's cool. I think some of the understanding that we have about humanity has to come from our understanding of the Trinity.
Yeah, absolutely.
The relational circle dance. Even if we talk about relationships, the necessity of relationships, that we were created with the necessity of relationships, that comes out of
And let us, I mean, people say, well, there's no Trinity in the Bible. Are you kidding me? It's right there in the beginning. Let us, Jesus, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and all things were made for him. I mean, so Jesus is there before time. And so I deal with this in the book that I wrote with Frank Viola called Jesus Theography, a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So the part of the Imago Dei then, for created in that image of the Trinity, that need for relationship, but also the ability for love and capacity for love is got to be innate.
Exactly. And it's agape love too. It's not just any kind of love. Mm-hmm. It's this self-sacrificing, lay it down love that Jesus talked about. Greater love is no one than this, that you lay it down. That's agape love, lay it down love. You're willing to lay down your life. And that's there. That's what it means. That, you know, when God created the universe, God created the universe out of what already existed. What existed was this relationship. Trinity that exists in relationship. So, I mean, the irony is, if you ask any physicist today, or ask any biologist or whatever, what is the essence of reality? Give me a mathematical definition. You pin them into the wall. What is matter reality about? And they will go, one word. The word they will use is relationship. Nothing exists outside of relationship. I mean, the definition of matter for superstring physicists is a vibrating string of energy.
Yeah.
Basically, they're saying matter is music, but music is that all about relationship. And, you know, so it's really, it's incredible. We're living in now in actually a convergence of science and theology. I'm not sure how long we'll be there, but I'm enjoying it while it's lasting.
I mean, it's incredible to see that imagery and realizing, you know, we live in a society where there's almost an epidemic of loneliness. And yet, you know, that just, you know, when we are created for relationship, you know, it's can only be filled by God, but yet, you know, that's a big thing there. Isn't it?
Yeah. I was thinking about this with, you know, screen. I love books. Okay. I'm a bookaholic.
I've seen your book collections.
There's an extrovert, an introvert, and there's a booktrovert, you know, and I'm a booktrovert. So I grew up with these artifacts, you know, that that just captured me and enraptured me. Our kids I became addicted to books. They're addicted to a screen.
Right.
And that screen is a whole different world than that book.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that appeal of that screen is connection. I mean, that's one of the things we don't understand, that books didn't really connect you.
Right.
But screens connect you, but they promise what they can't fulfill, which is relationship. You need the human touch. You need the human smell. You need all those things that they stimulate. The screen says it, but it never connects us really. Right. Hence the loneliness. And the loneliness is getting worse because the screens promise something that they cannot deliver.
Which, you know, I mean, that leads into really one of the primary purposes of the church, to provide relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah. But we've been more centers of principles and doctrines and all that stuff.
Enlightenment.
How many pastors think of themselves as relationship ministers, relationships? Yeah. I mean, it's amazing to me how that just misses us, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though, you know, pastor by definition would be relational.
Right.
You know, I had a conversation with somebody the other day and commented how we no longer call the room the pastor has in the church the pastor's study. It's now the pastor's office.
Yeah.
And just the indication of a shift there.
Yeah. Well, it needs to be the studio, but that's the future.
I love it.
It's the artist has a studio. Yeah.
Going back to the painting and just the whole idea of art, that is central to the image of God in us, isn't it?
Yeah.
The creativity.
We are all artists in some way. I mean, actually, the word tecton, Jesus was a tecton. Okay, so we mistranslated as carpenter. I mean, if anybody's ever been to the Holy Land, how many trees you see? I mean, give me a break. this is a desert setting, you know?
Houses are built out of trees.
Yeah, so, you know, the idea of these Renaissance painters of portraying Jesus and Joseph in this carpenter shop. I mean, it's cute, but tecton, T-E-K-T-O-N, literally means craftsman, artisan is based on techne, T-E-C-H-N-E, which is Latin for artist. I mean, so here we got an image of Jesus.
Artisan.
As an artist at what he's doing. And it can also mean, I mean, tecton can also mean, you know, a mason, somebody who works with metal, but it can also mean an architect or somebody who's an artist with words. So it has a huge meaning. And we just reduce it as carpenter. Jesus was a carpenter. No, you got to expand it. He's an artist. And he's showing us what it means to be an art with our humanity in life. And that's what it means to follow Jesus.
Probably the comparison of Jesus to carpenter, it would be far better to compare him to Michelangelo.
Yeah.
You know, architect, sculptor, painter, writer.
All of the above. Yeah. Or Da Vinci. Exactly.
One of the things in Jesus Human, I was going to ask you about, there's a statement that you make. It says, no one is, I've got it written down here, no one is born a human, only the capacity to become one. And then we are born latent, but born with the birthright to be humans. Can you kind of elaborate on that? The reason I'm asking is because it's here's where it challenges me is that, okay, a baby, we're saying now a baby's not born human.
Well, Niebuhr said you only understand original sin when you have a child.
Never had to teach a child how to do bad.
every child lives total. I mean, they're cute, wonderful, you know, puppies, if you will, but they're totally into themselves. I mean, that's with Mabel, my granddaughter.
Yeah, your granddaughter.
Wants me to she wants to tell me about me, you know, Mabel, it's all about Mabel. So yeah, there is this, you know, we have that DNA, but it has to come out and be nourished and watered and all that stuff.
Yeah. We're not saying there's no value in that.
In latent, that's the DNA has got to come out and be cultivated.
Which then becomes our lifelong goal is to become like Jesus.
But I don't like the word like though, Dave.
Yeah. Yes, I knew that.
I don't like that doctrine of Christ-likeness, that we are just so
manifest,
not mimic. You know, the promise of the gospel is Jesus wants to live in us. I mean, 164 times Paul goes in Christ in us, the hope of glory, you know. So he wants us to live in us, that we share life with him, that he lives his resurrection life in and through us. And that's the real meaning of Christian, little Christ. So,
that's
and the paradox true. Again is that the more Christ lives in us, the more we become a unique, original, one of a kind human.
Yeah,
we don't become clones. Yeah. We become, because Jesus is this billion faceted, trillion faceted light, you know, and so we all express a little facet of that uniquely. And so that uniqueness of who Christ is, the more Christ lives in us, the more we become who God made us to be. One of a kind, original, unrepeatable, irreplaceable.
Awesome. You know, the uniqueness and the value in that. In the book, you have this whole list of inhuman dreams, and I thought it was interesting. But one of them is inhuman dream of intellectualism. And the reason I bring it up is I know typically us Pentecostals, we've been a little hesitant with intellectualism. So we're going, yeah. But you've spent the majority of your life in academia. So what can you kind of, how do we balance that? What's the inhuman part of intellectualism?
Well, let me give it to you in a metaphor, right? Intellectuals are people that go deep. They dive deep. Okay. And the problem is when you dive deep, you can dive so deep that when you come up for air, you can't talk to anybody else. So you have to have a surface. You have to have surface time. We don't like the word surface. We think surface means shallow.
Right.
But this is the problem with intellectualism, is that you just talk to one another. You can't talk to anybody else. The average academic article has a readership of 3.6 people.
Yeah. I wonder who the 0.6 was.
I'll never forget when early in my academic career, I spent a whole year working on this article that I published in Church History. A whole year of my life. Think of that. After I published the article came out, I read that the average readership was 3.6 people. And I'm going, oh, there's got to be a better way. So, I mean, I still want to do the scholarship, but I want to do it in a way that can communicate, come up to the surface. That's where you connect with others. And that's where the joy comes. I mean, there's joy in diving deep, but you do get deep in the surface at the same time. So I'm a shallow person and I'm a deep person. I want to do both.
I think that gets called public theology.
Yeah. I'd like people to understand me a little bit, you know? I mean,
that's cool. Well, listen, let's just jump into the deep end in order to make it shallow for a minute and talk about some of the big things, you know, facing humanity right now, like genetic modification. I know you talk a little bit in your book about it, transhuman, AI.
Yeah.
What are kind of the implications? You know, let's just think about the genetic modification, CRISPR on, CRISPR off, you know, all of those things. What are the implications for us in God's image?
And this is, again, why you need, I'm in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, my birth story, our birth story, every day. Because the things are coming at us so fast. And I have an acronym called GRAIN, G-R-A-I-N. Genetic engineering, robotics, artificial intelligence, information technology, and nanotechnology. We're living in a grainy world. These are the driving technological forces of our day. Genetic engineering, robotics, AI, information technology, and nanotechnology. Are they going to drive us to our destruction or drive us to human betterment? And, you know, in our birth story, the first command of God, where the first time God speaks in Genesis 2, which is literally older than Genesis 1, we got a macro and a micro creation account. And in the micro one, the first time God speaks, the first command, the first words, and first words are important. You know, the first words of your children, you know.
Yes.
First words and last words. But first time God speaks, the first command is eat freely. Okay.
Hmm.
First time God speaks, eat freely.
Right.
Now, if you go back to Revelation, the end of the story, there's a last command. The last command God gives is drink freely.
Right.
You got the bookends of the Bible, you know, and that's why I say the Bible is not a text. It's a table on which we feed on Christ with thanksgiving. But so we get a yes, a big yes. Eat freely of all the trees I've given you, all this. So how many trees are there? The God, well, thousands of with food, you know. We got a thousand yeses, but then we got one, but don't go there. So we get a go there, eat freely, but don't go there, don't eat of that tree. And so that's where we need to be strong in our story, to live our own story, to stay in our story.
Right.
And to say to this culture, go there. Now, you want to clone tomatoes to feed the world? Tomatoes are tomatoes. I mean, it's a tomato. But you want to clone a human? Don't go there. Don't go there.
Right.
You know, so if you want to do genetic modification for foods and vegetables so they last longer, and okay, I'm all right. Go there. But you start working on humans here and doing that? No, don't go there. So that's why I think it's really important that we learn our story, our birth story. We stay in our story. We say to this culture, now you're not in my story now. You're not in the story. That's not my story.
Right.
That's not the story that God has given us for humans. Right. That's not the human story. And that's where the power of these, we get this first command, but we also have this prime directive, tend and till. Tend means conserve what I've created. Not preserve. Right. You preserve pickles. All right. We're not preservationists. We're conservation. We conserve what God has created. Right. But then but cultivate. Continue my creativity. Right. Continue. I don't like the word co-creator, because if you're co-anything with God, you know, the old bumper sticker, if God is your co-pilot, somebody's in the wrong seat. I'm not co-anything with God. God has I'm a sub-creator. I'm a subcontractor.
Right. Yeah.
We continue God's creativity. And we don't go off on our own. And so there's this constraint here. So yes, God's a conservative first, but then God's a liberal. But you got to bring them together, you know, conserve, and conceive, continue my creativity. And that's the, so we, and with each one of these, genetic engineering, robotics, I think we have to put it through that, our story grid. It's a story board that we've been given.
Right.
And we ought to be able to say, does this continue God's creativity that we know of in the whole story? Or are we going off on our own?
So let's take two concrete examples and maybe just try to process them through the story. So one, CRISPR genetic modification of inheritable traits. So something that's going to, you know, we're changing eye color in my family. It's already blue, but we don't like blue, so we're going to green because that's my wife's color. So my kids and my grandkids will all have green, you know, green eyes. But we've had to modify our DNA to do that. And it's going to change the way my descendants appear. Does that fit our story?
That it's a really good example because for me, color is not, it's bringing my preferences into, it's inserting too much of me in
it. Right.
Now, if you've got a hereditable disease,
right, sure,
then I don't have it. Yes. I mean, God gave us.
So the other example then would be sickle cell.
Yeah.
So sickle cell is now curable by genetic modification for future generations.
Exactly.
And you would say that we're good.
Yeah.
And would it be appropriate to look at that and say, okay, what we're doing here is we're actually bringing the kingdom to this situation because the fall brought all the disease. And we're restoring kingdom by eliminating that disease.
Yeah. You're not restoring kingdom by choosing the color of your eyes.
Right. Yeah, no, that's 100% fair in saying that. And, you know, there's a lot of genetic treatment of diseases, or that's the goal with it anyway. Of course, it's been commercialized and all the rest of it, but as that goes. So the other part, and it's a part of your grain, is AI. You know, I think there's a lot of people that are getting kind of a little afraid of AI, especially in the church. How does that fit into our story?
Well, again, if AI is being used to facilitate and to uplift your own creativity that God gave you, so you're enhancing it through AI, I have no problem with it. But for you to go to AI and say, write my essay, then you've dumped your creativity on something else.
Right.
You know, I have a problem with commas. You know, I either put in too many commas or not enough. And every editor that I work with, either I'm too many commas or not enough. So I just use AI now as my editor, you know.
Yeah. Grammarly is a great tool.
Yeah, exactly. So my editor is AI to help me get rid of my commas. But I'm not asking AI to write my stuff. You with me? So I'm writing my own stuff, but you help me deal with my handicaps and my little quirks and my
helping, not replacing. It's helping you,
right? It's an enhancement, of my creativity, and enables it and lifts it up. This is the danger. Every augmentation is an amputation. Every time augmentation, I mean, you still doing slide rules?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I never did.
Okay, well, I had these big, huge slide,
I missed it.
Slide rules. I could never figure out how to work them. But thank God the calculator came along. And I was at a time when we had, when I was going to school, they actually had calculators, but the teachers were saying, no, you got to learn to use a slide rule. I'm going, why do I have to learn a slide rule? I got a calculator. So that augmentation of a calculator was an amputation of a slide rule.
Slide rule.
That's not a bad amputation as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
You can deal with that amputation and diminish our humanity.
Right.
And so with AI, there's this question of, okay, it's a huge augmentation, but what are the amputations that are taking place that diminish us and will ultimately destroy us? So that's the go there, don't go there.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's excellent, excellent guidelines. Just kind of one more question. This is a final question. I know that you've written a lot of books, and Jesus Human goes a lot deeper on this particular topic, but many of your books deal with this. If somebody listening to the podcast today in our church says, hey, I'd like to read more about who I am in Christ, who I was created, all that kind of stuff. Have you got a book or two you could recommend?
Of my books?
Others, well, yours, you know, we'll recommend all your books, you know, but maybe.
I think Jesus Manifesto is for me a kind of a benchmark book that really says it as crisply and as clearly as you can, the centrality and supremacy and sovereignty of Christ. And so that really, for me, is a book that I might say, it's the first of a trilogy I wrote with Frank Viola. The first was Jesus Manifesto. Right. Second was Jesus Theography. Third was Jesus Speaks. But that Jesus Manifesto might be. It is a short book too, so.
Okay, well, that's, everybody wants short books.
Everybody wants short books. Not like Jesus Human, you know, just.
Yeah. It's not, Jesus Human isn't all that, you know, isn't one a super long
book. No, it's big print too, so, you know.
I have to admit, I read it on a Kindle, so I get that one. And Designer Jesus is a great follow-up to that. Now, are you planning a third one in that series as well, or just the two?
Yeah, I didn't write them each volume stands on its own, but I wanted to deal with your theological anthropology and Jesus Human, but then I just wanted to deal with what does discipleship mean? And I wrote the book, so I like the book, and I think it's the best book on discipleship out there. If you want to know what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, read Designer Jesus. So
yeah,
that's right.
What are you working on now? You're always working on something. What else is coming out?
I'm working on a textbook on semiotics.
Okay.
God's love language.
Awesome.
Sign language is God's love language. So
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Which is definition of semiotics.
Exactly. So
that's great. I love it. For those that are listening, that's the definition, sign language. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about this. And I know the church is going to really appreciate
it. Well, it's been fun. I love interacting with you, Dave. And we're kindred spirits in so many ways. So.
Awesome.
Thanks. All right. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining us on today's episode of Ask a Theologian. If you're enjoying our show, it would be really helpful to us if you gave us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you use to consume your podcasts. And if you have time, a written review would be even better. But either way, we hope you are enjoying the podcast. And if you've got questions, please send your questions. Who knows, maybe I'll be able to feature your question on a future episode of Ask a Theologian. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.